Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the show today. Some time ago, Paul Simon wrote one of my favorite songs, 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover. And today we're talking about 50 Ways to Leave Your 40s. Sheila Key is my first guest, and she's going to share how you can keep the boom in baby boomer. And regardless of age, she's got some great tips in her book for living life full out. In the second half of today's show, we'll be talking with journalist Amy Sutherland. Amy had a great assignment at an animal training school, and when she returned home, she wrote a column for the New York Times about how she applied some of the animal training techniques she learned on her husband and how that helped spice up her marriage. And that column became the New York Times' most emailed article of 2006, led to scores of media interviews and eventually to Amy's new book, What Shamu Taught Me About Life, Love, and Marriage. That's coming up at 12:30 today. But first, we're joined by Sheila Key. She's an award-winning writer, graphic designer, and a former radio broadcaster and on-air personality. And together with Dr. Peggy Spencer, Sheila wrote 50 Ways to Leave Your 40s, Living It Up in Life's Second Half. Co-author Dr. Spencer practices at the Student Health Center at the University of New Mexico, and both authors live in Albuquerque. Sheila, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me, Vicki.
Well, your book has been described as a tonic for, and I'm quoting here, midlife blues, as joyful, irreverent, and informative, and full of good, juicy, inspiring words and ways to live as a gloriously aging soul. So how would you describe it? Why did you write this book? Who did you write it for?
Yeah, well, it is a fun book. I was really glad to see in all of the various reviews and endorsements that the word joy kept coming up.
Mm.
We really are talking about being joyful. You know, the old joke about, you know, the alternative.
Really?
Like the only alternative to waking up 50 one day is not that great an option. So might as well be joyful.
Absolutely. And I just read in the book that as recently as 1901, the average life expectancy was only 49 years old.
Can you believe it was that recent?
It's quite shocking. Yeah.
I was shocked by that. Just a scant, you know, a little bit over 100 years ago, a baby born could be expected to live about 49 years. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it is.
Now it's 107 years later. We hit 50 hard. We just keep on running.
Right. And then they describe 50 now as the new 40 and 40 as the new 30. Do you buy into that theory?
Well, you know, I like the sound of it. I think that it applies to, you know, those who are making, you know, pretty good life, you know, lifestyle choices. I mean, I don't think we can all be guaranteed that if we're sitting around eating bonbons on the couch that we're going to, you know, necessarily have a feel like 35 when we're really 50.
Sure.
Yeah. I had an experience a few years ago after sitting around too much. I decided, oh, I think I'll build a garden. By the time I finished pushing all that dirt around, oh, my God, I was crippled. I truly went and did a stint in physical therapy.
Oh, really? Well, I can somewhat relate to that.
Yeah, and that's like there was a message for me.
Yeah, I have to sit a lot, or I have two desks. One of them is a standing desk, and I stand at that a lot.
Good.
Too.
The standing desk. Yeah. That's something we should have put in the book, Vicki.
Yeah, but I went and bought a border collie because they require inordinate amounts of exercise.
excellent choice. And you know, it's funny because when I brought Peggy on board, I had been developing the book idea since I was only 40.
Mm.
It came to me as a gift from someone who had just celebrated her 50th, and I was only 40. And so the project, after kind of coming out like a shot, then it just sort of went underground for a while. But when I was 45, then I dug it back up and blew the dust off it and eventually brought Peggy Spencer on board, and she's a medical doctor. She looked at the list and said, you know, you've covered a lot here. but where's friendship? Mm. And I went, oh, friendship, that's important. You know, so we added a chapter on friendship and had to pitch one of the other ones or just kind of fold them in together. But one of the things, you mentioned your border collie. I don't think pets made it into the book exactly. But they're there in spirit in the friendship chapter.
Yeah. And they're
But I think you're really onto something. If you can make a lifestyle choice that happens to work on a bunch of different levels, hey!
And that's what it's all about. It's lifestyle choices. And you know what? I have to say that, if I can just brag about my dog for a moment.
Absolutely. What's your border collie's name?
His name is Dylan, because I wanted to give him a Welsh name since he's a Welsh border collie. But he is absolutely perfect for me because he loves the outdoor. He loves the water. I've taken him kayaking and sailing, and we go hiking in the mountains, and he's just perfect for me. So it's a good choice to make.
Yeah, it's a good fit. And, you know, we lost our, you know, we had to say goodbye to a long-time pet. A dog, a little Westie.
Mm.
And so at Christmas time, wouldn't you know, there's a new little fur bundle at our house. Well, this dog is just growing into the most enormous dog. It's a Heinz 57.
Uh-huh.
You know the breed?
I know that you get a nice surprise as they grow up because you're never quite sure.
Oh, my goodness. And it doesn't matter how big she grows. We named her Tally.
Mm.
It doesn't matter how big Tally grows. Her feet still look too big.
Uh-huh.
So I have this feeling she's still growing bigger. But dwelling on this idea of the pet as a lifestyle choice, you know, I could have chosen a lap dog.
Mm-hmm. Yes, true.
But you know what? I come home from an outing. And, of course, I sit right down at my computer to catch up on the email and whatnot. That dog comes over with the ball in her mouth, and she will not take no for an answer.
Mm-hmm.
It's time to exercise.
Yes. Yeah, you don't have a lot of choice once they are of a certain age and know what happens.
Yeah, but, you know, I think there's just a lot that they can teach us that way, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Like, you must exercise.
Yeah. Yes, and I think the way we look at age is a choice. And I follow Richard Bach's philosophy because I, you know, I've got friends in their 20s, friends in their 80s, and even one in their 90s. And he goes by Richard Bach wrote Jonathan Livingston's Seagull, of course, and he goes by the philosophy that he is ageless. And that's my approach to life. Age does not matter. The number does not matter.
Right, and see, we have a way called that. We called our chapters ways, the 50 ways.
Right.
There's one in there called Act Ageless.
Right.
Has anyone ever said to you, "Act your age"?
Maybe yes.
Not lately.
Yes.
But you know, I mean, what does that mean? You know, and especially once we get into adulthood, you know, what does that mean?
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, we address that. You know, it's funny. Age just doesn't matter in the big things in life. Age is pretty irrelevant. You know.
Yeah. Yeah, and I was going to ask you if you'd share some of your philosophy from the book. And you actually broke the book into four parts, body, mind, soul, and heart, which is a little different to many books out there. And you have a chapter on ageless. And I wonder if you'd just share some of your deeper philosophies on that with us.
On the ageless one?
Yeah.
Well, we start with that famous quote, you know, that Gloria Steinem talked about, this is what 50 looks like. And then before long, we're dancing in that chapter. And the joke is, you know, I mean, because I said, if anyone says, you know, act ageless, I mean, act your age, it's just such an insult, unless it's issuing from the mouth of Prince, you know, because he sings a song where he says, act your age, mama, not your shoe size.
Right.
But some of the things we do in there is like, you know, we first try to dispense with this notion that being 50 means something specific any more than, you know, being, I don't know, Welsh.
Right.
Or being Heinz 57.
Right.
But then we get into, you know, if you want to, I actually like this idea of putting your age into action. You know, like doing something 50 times, planting 50 trees, or, you know, peeling off what I finally got to the bottom of who is on the $50 bill. It's Ulysses S. Grant.
Mm-hmm.
And you could peel off a Ulysses S. Grant and give it to, you know, some charity you've been wanting to support and just haven't, you know. This idea of putting 50 into action.
Right. Now, you haven't yet turned 50, right? You are
no,
about
correct.
To?
No, correct. I'm 40. I'm 48.
Okay.
And Peggy is, as we say, leaving her 40s on June 1st, so she'll get there sooner. But we, what we did, besides dividing the 50 chapters into the four sections of body, mind, soul, and heart, we also gave each chapter sort of a template, where each chapter has a move. We call them cool moves. They're not always exercises. Sometimes they are, but sometimes they're just, sometimes they're a coordination challenge,
mm-hmm.
you know, because that's a mind wiring sort of a thing.
Right.
And sometimes they're just, well, the one that always springs to mind is the neti pot. It's just something that a lot of Americans haven't heard of. And many of us suffer from sinus allergies, and we take pills every day, you know, and we're miserable. But this is it's a nasal rinse.
Right.
You use a little pot, fill it with some saline that you make yourself. You know, you just a little salt, a little warm water, and you pour it in one nostril, and it flows out the other. And it's fabulous for our upper respiratory health.
Right.
And there's no drugs involved. So we've got cool moves in every chapter. We've got a writing prompt in every chapter. And then Dr. Spencer adds a medical column. And these are interesting, too. In some chapters, she does sort of a Western medicine roundup on a particular health issue, like heart health or
like stinky feet is the one I'm looking at.
Which one are you looking for?
I just happened to open the page at a doc in the box, it's called, and this one happens to be stinky feet.
Yes, that's the one in the chapter called Run for Your Life, where we're talking about not necessarily running per se, but getting some aerobic exercise on a regular basis. And so much of our aerobic exercise relies on our feet. And what Peggy has noticed in her practice, and by the way, she works at a student health facility. Many of her clients, her patients, are young. And they complain, oh, they don't get enough exercise because their feet hurt. You know,
right.
It's the most common complaint. So yeah, we've got some foot care in there. Whether they're stinking or hurting or the arches are falling or...
Yeah. So you have your philosophies, if you like. You have a segment in every chapter this is. You have a segment, as you said, called Cool Moves. And then you have the Doc in the Box, which had the stinky feet episode in it. And then you've got a section called Things to Try at Least Once. And
right.
Another section called
Scribbles and Doodles. Scribbles and Doodles. Now, Scribbles and Doodles are mostly writing prompts, journaling prompts. But there's a few that are really just about scribbling and doodling, too, which is kind of fun.
Mm.
The emphasis all the way throughout is fun and trying new things.
Yeah.
So that Things to Try at Least Once section ranges from party ideas to, standing on one foot. You know,
right.
To give yourself a balance challenge. I mean, it's really all over the map. But the whole, in the main, the whole emphasis is toward trying new things and improving your health habits and your mental outlook, even just a little. And the importance of trying new things, it's not just to have some new experiences. There are actually health benefits that accrue from trying new things. We can still grow our brains, even at this age. They didn't used to think so, those neuroscientists. You know, they told us that once the human brain had grown into adulthood, it was pretty well fixed,
right.
Like set in stone. And any damage you might sustain, you know, the joke about the brain cells and drinking them away or whatever, or more serious stroke or physical trauma to the brain, now what they're finding, they used to say that such damage would be permanent. But so many, quote, miraculous recoveries from serious brain injury have begun to tell neuroscience that the brain remains plastic.
Right. And isn't that good news for everyone?
That
isn't
is good news for everyone, even if you're not a stroke victim and never will be.
Right.
It's still good news that by having new experiences and by trying new things, you actually literally grow new neural pathways in your brain. I think that's very exciting.
It is. Well, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Sheila Key, author of 50 Ways to Leave Your 40s.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Tune into Conversations Live with Vicki Sinclair next Monday at noon and hear how one woman's relentless passion helped to inspire those who were told they were a lost cause. Erin Gruwell joins Vicki to discuss Beyond the Freedom Riders. Also in that hour, find out how to dump that jump with relationship expert and psychologist Dr. Deborah Mandel. That's coming next Monday at noon on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
The answer is easy if you take it logically. I'd like to help you in your struggle to be free. There must be 50 ways to leave your lover.
Following the herd is fine until they lead you off a cliff. Think for yourself. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back, everyone. We're talking today with Sheila Key in the first half of the show. And we're talking about 50 ways to leave your 40s, living it up in life's second half. And Sheila co-wrote this book with her co-author, Peggy Spencer, Dr. Peggy Spencer. And Sheila, I wanted to talk a little about ego attachment because, you know, we all know people, we all have people in our lives who only show up when they want to tell us their exciting news or when they need something from us. And you say that's, you know, those people who have to brag about the biggest, the best, the newest, the tallest, it's all ego attachment. And I wanted to talk a little bit about ego attachment and how that can help free us to enjoy life more.
Yeah, well, you know, I wish I could say I'm a real specialist on ego attachment and that I've really gotten over it, you know. But the truth is our ego is there for a reason. And it's really important to have an ego, and the ego very much is credited with, you know, helping us survive. So we don't want to, like, throw away our ego. But if you really look at it, some of the stuff, so much of the stuff that makes us miserable in life is some kind of ego attachment. Mm-hmm. If we're miserable because our house isn't as big as, you know, the next guy, or we don't earn as much money, you know, those are ego attachments. And mm-hmm. It's not really what really, really matters in life. And the way this got in the book was, you know, that you begin, I think it's a real midlife thing, realization for a lot of people. They begin to get sick or, I mean, seriously ill, or someone they love gets seriously ill or has some kind of brush with death or whatever. Eventually, it's that perspective changing kind of experience, you know, where you come to know finally that those things just aren't that important compared to friendship and love and, you know, those kinds of things.
Yeah. And if we realize that before we get to a life crunch situation, it makes life so much easier, doesn't it?
Yeah. And, you know, that like there's another chapter besides the enlighten up dude, the one that we've been talking about. There's this other chapter, Mind Your Karma, Trim Your Dog.
I had that right on next on my list.
Yes, as a matter of fact, it comes right directly before. You know, we mean well when we offer our help, but a lot of times our help isn't really wanted, you know? And so, again, it's an ego thing. Like, why don't you do it the way I do it? Well, because I do it the way I do it, you know? And so I think that one of the secrets to happiness is that you just let go of some of those ego attachments that you can't control anyway. You don't get to decide how other people are or, you know?
Right. And the chapter there is called Mind Your Karma, Trim Your Dogma. And the question you ask on that is, would it fit on a bumper sticker? What's your dogma? What's your credo to live by? And would it fit on a bumper sticker? So I want to ask you what your credo is.
I'll tell you what. I discovered it in writing this book, and it's just so perfect for me. It's love, love, love.
There you go.
That's my credo. Love, love, love. It's the name of one of our chapters. But it's also one of the exercises in our book, one of the writing, one of the scribbles and doodles is write your epitaph. And, you know, when you're chiseling in stone, it's hard work. Mm-hmm. So you want to keep it short. And so that's what I decided mine should be. And the joke, of course, because I'm very talkative, The joke, the amazing part is that I got it down to one word, and then the joke is that I would say it three times.
Well, there you go. I mean, if
so
it works for you, it works for you, right?
Yeah. How about you? Do you have a credo that, or sort of a code to live by that could fit on a bumper sticker? It's a big challenge.
I think
it?
Mine is about joy. I remember, not to get too morbid, but when my father was literally on his deathbed and he gave me my speech that I will always, you know, keep in my heart, but it was about joy and don't do things if they don't bring you joy and don't live a life that does not bring you joy.
Right.
And so I do ask myself that sometimes when I'm considering new things. Is this something I really want to do? Is this something that's going to bring me joy? And sometimes you think things are going to bring you joy and they stop becoming joyful. So stop doing them, you know?
Yeah.
without being flaky, of course.
Yeah. But that's really one of the themes that just runs through our book is we haven't spoken directly about this idea of the holistic ways and the more Eastern ways. I started to say that Peggy's Doc in the Box, sometimes it's sort of a medical roundup from a Western perspective, but in many of the other chapters, her column will take a look at an alternative, what used to be called alternative therapy.
Right.
Nowadays, it's more often called integrative medicine or complementary care.
Our listeners are very much into holistic lifestyles, so they would appreciate that.
At the heart of holism is this idea that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts,
right.
That we're all interconnected, and that all of our parts are interconnected, you know, that all of our, from a health point of view, mm-hmm. all of our systems are interconnected, and so it doesn't make sense to treat just this one part if really, you know, it's more like you should look at the entire organism, see
right.
what's going on,
right.
And again, not just physically, but also emotionally and mentally, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
What?
Oh, go ahead.
Why do you think so many people have this fear, if you want, or anxiety attached to that zero at the end of a birthday?
You know, it is just such a slap up against the head, you know, that it's another decade. It's not just another birthday.
Mm.
It's another decade gone, and I guess that's what it is.
Mm.
We know it's gone.
Right.
But that, I think that's probably at the root of the so-called midlife crisis, you know? You kind of look at your watch and go, oh, my God, you know? I think we can fool ourselves when we're turning 40 mm. and getting that bouquet of black balloons.
Right,
you know, we can
right.
laugh and go, yeah, but I'm only 40, you know?
Yeah.
But 50 just sounds...
Well, it's that much closer to 60, isn't it?
But we just can't pretend that 50 is... I mean, when you've just turned 40, that means you just flopped out of your 30s. You can still pretend you're young, you know?
Yeah.
But by the time you're 50, it's like, no, you are really, truly grown up now.
Yeah.
And so I think people go, ah! You know,
yeah.
Oh, like the white rabbit checking his watch, you know? There was so much I was going to do. I got to go.
Right.
Either that or the crisis comes in the form of a real crisis. And again, I think it's that quite often it's medical. Or
yeah.
sometimes it has to do with your aging parents. You begin to see that they are now seriously losing some of their independence.
Mm.
Not, I don't want to say losing their independence. You're trying to balance their having their independence, but also making sure that they're safe, you know.
Mm.
That if they've got a bad knee, they're not in a place with a real steep staircase or that kind of thing, you know.
Right.
These are the things that let us know, geez, another whole bunch of time has gone by. So one of our chapters is Book 'em Dano, and people will recognize that, people of a certain age, will recognize that as a very, you know, popular line from television in the 70s. It was Hawaii 5-0, and
right.
wouldn't it be 5-0? but what we mean by Book 'em is even if you can't schedule it right now, you should at least get down on a list the biggies that you want to accomplish. You know, get them down. And then start, you know, keep that list where you can see it, you know.
Mm-hmm. It's
again,
so
just those
important.
Little nudges.
Yeah. It's so important because time does go so quickly. And, you know, I find myself always caught up with, well, this quarter, I can't believe the first quarter of this year has gone. So.
Yeah. Yeah, there it is. And, you know, I was 40 when this book idea came. And, you know, I was 45 when I signed with the publisher, New World Library. And sure enough, now I'm 48. I mean, you know, it just keeps marching, you know.
Well, what have you learned? What have you learned over the last 15 years that you wish now that you wish you'd known back then?
Oh, let's see. That is a fabulous question. Oh my goodness, the Serenity Prayer. I wish someone had sat me down when I was like little and taught me the Serenity Prayer. Mm. You know the one? Give me the wisdom. I always have to stop and think about what all the words are.
Strength to know the wisdom, or I know the one you mean. Yeah,
understanding that the only things you really have any control over have to do with yourself. Period. And then there's all the stuff you can't change, and you know you hope to have the serenity to accept all those things you can't change. Mm. You know, that's what I wish I'd known is that really, truly, this is the way to happiness, is understanding you can't change everything, and in any situation that's making you unhappy, you get to decide, do I put up with it? Do I change it? I mean, can I change it?
Right.
Or do I just accept it?
Right. And that's a great note to end our show on, our segment with you. And we're not ending the show, but the segment with you. It flew by, and I thank you for being with us, Sheila. And I want you to give out your website so people can check out. I know you have a blog and
more
information about the book.
Yeah, we've 50 Ways to Leave Your 40s.com, www, and then we use the numerals, 50 Ways to Leave Your 40s.com.
Okay, so say that again.
www. 50 Ways to Leave Your 40s.com.
Great.
And it's also numerals in the 50 and 40.
Yeah, yeah. And it's also on conversationslive.net. If listeners didn't catch that, it's right up there too. They can link straight to you from there. Well, thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate
it. Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
And thanks for putting us on your website too. I appreciate that.
Have a great day.
Hey, you too.
And my guest, of course, was Sheila Key. She's the co-author with Dr. Peggy Spencer of 50 Ways to Leave Your 40s, Living It Up in Life's Second Half and Keeping the Boom in Baby Boomer. Please stay with us. We'll be right back with journalist Amy Sutherland, who's going to tell you what she learned about marriage from Shamu.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
Across Seattle, humans are vanishing, returning as newborn vampires. With the sun as her enemy, the moon her guiding light. Manali must battle the beast who tortured her. But first, she must face her own demons in Otherworld. Romantic Times magazine calls Gallinoran's best-selling Otherworld series vivid, sexy, and mesmerizing. Darkling by Yasmin Gallinoran, available at bookstores now. For more information, see Gallinoran.com.
More choices, more topics, more shows. One station. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And my second guest today is journalist and author Amy Sutherland. She's the author of Kicked, Bitten, and Scratched and Cook Off. Her articles have appeared in the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, and the Boston Globe. And her latest book was based around a feature piece, which was in the New York Times. It became the most emailed article of 2006. And it was called What Shamu Taught Me About a Happy Marriage. And this book is based on that article. It's called What Shamu Taught Me About Life, Love, and Marriage, Lessons for People from Animals and Their Trainers. Amy Sutherland, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, please. This was such a great book. This was such a great book. I just loved it. I haven't quite finished it yet, but I read every word and it's wonderful.
Oh, good.
And I want to start off because you say, I'm a different person than I was 4 years ago. This was in an article or off your website, I think. I'm a different person than I was 4 years ago. I'm more optimistic, less judgmental, and have patience to spare. And this all started for you when you went on assignment. So tell us how what your assignment was and how this led to the book.
Well, I went on assignment actually for Disney Magazine onto the set of 102 Dalmatians. And why I was there, all the trainers, it turned out, had gone to school to become trainers, which was a real surprise to me that a school would exist. And it also was an academic program and really their Harvard University. And so that became the subject of my second book, which is Kick, Bitten, and Scratch. I followed a year in the life of Moorpark Community College's program for exotic animal training and the students as they went through it and worked with the school zoo of 150 so animals. So I went in just as a journalist, and I wasn't really looking to change. You know, I thought of myself as a pretty cool observer.
Right, right.
But they got me. And the year of sort of watching people essentially learn how to talk to animals using these very progressive methods really got to me, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And I started taking the lessons home to my own life.
Right.
Yeah.
And I saw that you were watching some particular animal training. It was called, what was it, LSR, least resistance, was it?
Least reinforcing. It's sometimes called least reinforcing scenario, and I've also seen it as least reinforcing stimulus. But that was sort of one of the, you know, I was already kind of tipping over the edge, so to speak, and starting to think about how these ideas applied to the human animals in my life. And then I followed the students to SeaWorld, where one of the trainers talked about this technique they use during training sessions, where if an animal does not do what they ask, say they ask for a flip or a jump, and the dolphin instead splashes the water or just blows the trainer off, the trainer will just pause for a few seconds and try to offer as neutral a response as possible to the animal, with the idea that you never know what is reinforcing to another thing. So that even correction, criticism, yelling, even things that we think are not reinforcing can in fact be so at some times. So they don't really respond. So this was a real eye-opener to me. There's something about this just finally crystallized what I had been doing for years with my husband, and that is every time he lost his keys, which I don't mind so much, but what I minded was that he would lose his temper.
And we've all been there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We all have some relationship, I think, to a key loser.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So like, you have one bad roommate in your life, and then you have a key loser somewhere, too. But, you know, so I realized that I was doing the opposite of what this dolphin trainer would suggest, in the sense that I was, when my husband was losing his temper, I was always engaging. I was always reinforcing by either helping or calling out suggestions or, you know, or getting mad back. You know, I used to yell at him, "You're upsetting the dog." That never worked, but it was somehow fun to for me to say. But anyhow, the point was that usually what would have just been a, you know, a case of missing keys turned into this domestic drama. Like a little, like a lot of these little things in our lives with people, you know, little things all of a sudden blow up into big things. And then you wonder, like, how it happened. Well, the dolphin trainer sort of explained to me how it was happening. So the next time I heard him, wrestling around in a drawer looking for keys, I just didn't help. I didn't engage. He lost his temper a little bit and in quick order found his keys.
Right.
And, you know, it was just that was the true aha moment for me. I mean, I was sort of just goofing around at that point with these animal training ideas, but that was like, you know, this has answered a problem I've had for years.
Right. And you, because you've been practicing this for a while now, and you say your husband now practices it back on you, you call this shamooing.
Yeah. My husband and I, you know, we're both writers, so we play a little too fast and loose with the English language sometimes, perhaps, between the two of us. But we've used that as a sort of shorthand for when to use these, when you know, to use these ideas in human interactions, like when can the principles of animal training be applied? So we'll say, can you shamoo that? Or how would you shamoo that? Or
right.
Right. And then we another saying, we say, that was very un-Shamu. When somebody does something, you know, that is un-Shamu. There's no other way to put it.
Right. And these principles, I mean, they've been around for years, really.
Yeah.
It was Skinner, and I've read management books on the same thing and child rearing books on the same thing.
Absolutely.
But you stress in here, for anybody who's bristling at the thought of, well, you know, you can't train people.
Right.
You stress in here that the person you worked hardest at changing was yourself.
Yeah.
So
I mean, that's fundamentally who got changed, was me. I mean, you have to change, just like the way animal trainers work. They change their behavior to communicate with the animals they're working with, whether they be a tiger or, you know, a camel or a dolphin. And for me, I did the same thing. I only can control my behavior, so I changed my behavior, and then how my husband or anybody else responds is up to them.
Mm. Absolutely. So it's a conscious interaction to solicit or reinforce the kind of behavior you want to see.
Right.
Yeah. So, and I know that when you're working with the animal trainers, this kind of fascinated me, that they said that animal training is not merely a job, but a way of life.
Yeah.
And they say, this is not what I do, but who I am. It's like a Zen Buddhist lesson in self-control.
Yeah. Well, that was the thing that I always found so fascinating about the profession. I mean, there's so many things about it that fascinates me about the people working with animals, but that was one of the fundamental things. And I thought to myself, you know, that they are able to exercise this much discipline and self-control to work with these animals, that it really inspired me to think, like, well, couldn't I have more of that in my own personal relationships?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you know, the students, when they would go in to learn to work with these animals, I think that they thought that they would learn the 10 easy steps to walk a cougar.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And it turns out that, no, in fact, what they did is learn how to be a better person, essentially.
Yeah, and they actually have a motto, the animal trainer's motto, it's never the animal's fault.
Yeah.
And so you adopted that in your marriage and in relationships around you.
Well, you know, one of the things that I really loved about progressive animal trainers is that they take the sort of right and wrong out of the interaction. You know, they look at things very neutrally and practically. So if an animal's not getting what they want or doing something they don't want, they don't think, oh, that's just a stupid animal or he's just a lazy animal. They think, you know, what would be plan B or C or D? They just keep trying to solve the problem.
Right, right.
Where we so easily just say, well, he's a slacker, or he's always late, or he's, you know, he doesn't care about me enough.
Yeah, or he's doing this just to annoy me. And you say you totally took out that personal aspect of things.
Well, as much as I can, because I am
still... Well, you are human.
I'm still a human animal. But I have taken out a lot of it. And, you know, I don't even take things as personally... I don't know if I'll be able to give a good example, but I definitely don't take things as personally with my husband as I used to. I've started to realize that a lot of these things he does that sort of get on my nerve have really nothing to do with me. It's just his way. It's not a comment on how much he cares about me.
Right. Well, one example you gave was when he's been biking and he leaves his stinky bike clothes all over the bedroom floor, and that used to really upset you. And then you realized it wasn't about you. It's just that he figures he'll do it later.
Yeah. And then he's forgetful.
Yeah.
So he does start out with the best intentions. But yeah, it was just sort of like a sort of series of just of incidences that just sort of speak to who my husband is and really had nothing to do with me.
Mm.
But I had always taken it as like, he doesn't care about me, and, you know, make it into this big Shakespearean inner monologue for myself.
Right, right.
But, you know, once I realized sort of that it didn't have anything to do with me, I can't say that it solved the biking clothes on the floor problem, but they didn't, they weren't so monumental to me anymore.
Mm. Well, so I wanted to talk about how we set our animals up for success. And
mm-hmm.
Because I know from reading the book that the animal trainers at the exotic park do not punish ever. They never punish. You only gave two incidences of where they actually punished. But and those were with big cats, I believe. So how do we set up our animals for success, whether they're human or the four-legged kind?
Right. Yeah. Two-legged, four-legged.
Two-legged, yeah.
One-legged, perhaps. Well, I mean, a couple things. One is that animal trainers work in what they call approximations, and that is basically a series of small steps that lead to a big, what they would call bigger behavior. Nobody says trick anymore. That's not PC. And so, you know, instead of teaching, expecting to teach an animal just how to flip from, you know, one moment to the next, it's all broken down into steps. And so they're always looking for progress. And so that's one way to start thinking about how we can make our human animals set up for success, especially, if, you know, so that we don't set the bar so high and that we don't miss steps of progress towards the bigger thing that we want, the bigger behavior.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so often we want we want somebody to go from person A to person B overnight, and we don't think about it as a steady progression instead.
Okay.
And too often, you know, we also think, like, if I just say it right, that's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then because we expect so much, we don't encourage anything along the lines, and then the people get discouraged and just give it up.
Right.
And then the other thing is just to think about, like, the fact that animal trainers don't work with animals that are having an off day. They don't work with animals that are having health problems. They don't work with animals that something is spooking them. There was a deer at the training school that was really, for some reason, freaked out when the winds would blow a certain direction. There was probably some kind of scent coming in. And so on those days, they didn't work with her because she was too upset. The sort of human equivalent to me is that too often, you know, that we basically are trying to make a point or drive home an example or something when the person we're dealing with is in no state of mind for that.
Mm.
You know, so it's like learning better to pick your moments. I mean, if somebody's already, like, either doesn't feel well or is worried about something, they're not real receptive.
Mm. Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah, but a lot of us, you know, they make such plain sense, but, you know, I don't know about you, but I used to persist, and it took spending a year in a zoo for me to finally sort of wake up to these little ways in which I kind of sabotaged my interactions with other people.
Yeah, it took me a big life change to realize that in several years of management school, I think.
Yeah.
Well, let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We're talking with Amy Sutherland. She's the author of What Shamu Taught Me About Life, Love, and Marriage, and you're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Just imagine it, chatting with a chimp and chimpanzee. Imagine talking to a tiger, chatting with a cheetah. What a neat achievement it would be. If we could talk to the animals, learn their languages, maybe take an animal degree.
Hi, everyone. I'm Buzz.
And I'm Robin, reminding you to catch The Living Life Show Thursdays at 2 p.m. right here on KKNW.
The Living Life Show is your weekly guide to living life better both at home and away.
Each week, we bring you interesting guests and industry experts who share their tips for your home and your vacations.
We even have some great recipes for you to try, and you can even see us make them on our website.
You bet. So be sure to listen Thursday at 2 p.m. to The Living Life Show right here on KKNW.
Commune with the Pop Oracle on the Radio 8 Ball Show. I'm Andras Jones, the host of the Radio 8 Ball Show, where we answer your questions by picking songs at random and interpreting them as the answers, like picking musical tarot cards. That's the Radio 8 Ball Show on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Don't miss the Radio 8 Ball Show at its new time, Fridays at noon, right here on Alternative Talk, 1150.
Everyone loves an attractive, healthy, brilliant smile. From Julia Roberts to Tom Cruise to Halle Berry. Nowadays, a gorgeous, healthy smile isn't just for the rich and famous, you know. Tune in to Dr. Q's Smile Talk Radio, Wednesdays at 2, and find out how you, too, can achieve, maintain, and tap into the power of a brilliant, healthy smile. Dr. Q's Smile Talk Radio, Wednesdays at 2.
1150kknw.com, your connection to Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
We'd learn to speak in antelope and turtle. Our Pekingese would be extremely good. If we were asked to sing in hippopotamus, we'd say why anonymous and would. And I am sure every octopus, place and platypus certainly would see it as a plus. If we could walk with those animals, talk with those animals, grunt and squeak and squawk with those animals, and they could talk to us.
Well, welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live. And my guest today, great choice on music, Eric. My guest today is Amy Sutherland. She's a journalist who spent a year at an exotic animal training school. And working with the trainers, she realized that she could probably take some of these techniques back home and use them on people in her life, especially her husband, and found very good positive results. So, Amy, I wanted to ask you, we were talking before the break about the correct way to, you know, set your animal up for mm-hmm. success. Mm-hmm. And you say in the book that there are they don't always reward, and there's no reward for trying, only
right.
doing. So I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about that.
Well, this is in the book, and it was a really good example of that, is that I was at SeaWorld with the students on a field trip, and at the beluga whale tank, they asked this male beluga whale to get up on the scale, which was on the pool, on the side of the pool, and he sort of just stuck his chin up and then sunk back into the water. Now, they just ignored that and didn't reinforce that in any way, and that's because he was sort of just trying to get on the scale, but he wasn't doing it, and they wanted him to do it, and this whale did know how to do it. So the next time they blew the whistle and gave him the cue, he, in fact, then jumped on the scale, and he was very show-offy about it, flipped his tail up and everything, so... It's like, so there, see, I can.
And oh, you know how many times I've been to SeaWorld? 23 times.
Oh, God, it's like the best place in the world. But
I know,
we'll have to have another show on that.
Yeah.
But the thing is that it made me think about how sometimes, without thinking, not realizing it, that I was reinforcing trying to do something with the people in my life. Rather, they were things that I really wanted them to do. But what I was doing was giving them reinforcement for just trying to do it.
Mm.
So as long as they were just getting lots for trying, they never would seem to move ahead to the next phase.
Yeah.
And the case, and the most way people sort of try, you know, doing quote marks in the air, is that they talk about doing something.
Right.
And then we give them loads and loads of reinforcement. Like, I talk about in the book, my mother talking about quitting smoking. We talk about it. I'd encourage her and blah, 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 blah. But it never would happen. So it started to dawn on me that I was giving her just lots of, you know, I was giving her buckets of fish, so to speak, for just talking about quitting.
Right.
Right? And I wanted her to quit.
Yeah, yeah.
So I should quit reinforcing talking about it.
Yes, makes sense, doesn't
yeah.
it? Yeah. And tell us about the jackpot, which you describe as a big, fat, juicy serving of positive reinforcement. When does your husband earn the jackpot?
Now that I hear it sounds terrible.
No.
But it's not supposed to be. Well, you know, they use the jackpot in the animal training world as when an animal really kind of goes above and beyond or else makes a major breakthrough, maybe something they've been having trouble learning to do, and then all of a sudden, bang, they do it. So I thought that, you know, that made sense with humans, too, because certainly, you know, if you're doling out the same level of reinforcement, you know, all the time, it gets a little predictable. And, you know, when people make a breakthrough, you should notice it. I mean, and the jackpot is sort of used in the workforce as the bonus, right?
Right.
But in human relationships, like one of the big jackpots I gave my husband was that I often come home from traveling and my husband isn't messy as much as he is a stacker. And so there's, you know the kind. So there's uh-huh. stacked mail and stacked uh-huh. newspapers. And he stacks stuff that I didn't even know could be stacked sometimes. But I came home once and the place was just perfect. It was perfectly clean. And so, you know, I just made a big deal out of it, which was the jackpot, just telling him how much I liked it and running around the house and, you know, acting kind of silly. But he got a kick out of it.
Right. I loved this line. I read in an article that somebody had written about you, and it said, attention, frustrated wives, if you want your husband to start listening to you, stop leaving his socks on the floor. All you need is a little patience and a lot of mackerel. So that brings up this point. Not everybody's the same. Not everybody's going
right.
to be motivated by the same reward.
Right.
So we really need to get to know who we're dealing with and what
right.
motivates
Absolutely.
Them, right?
Yeah. Well, and the thing is one of the examples I've given is, like, you know, some people like talk as a way of reinforcement, just getting the, you know, verbal attention or whatever. Some people find it reinforcing if you shut up.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, you have to know who you're engaged with, because that's the way trainers think, too. You know, they know they're not only the species they're working with, but the specific individual animal. And even in the animal kingdom, there's a range of what animals like and don't like. And so it sort of really brought home to me how, you know, these are obvious lessons, but it really brought home to me how everybody's unique, and you have to see it from their point of view. Like that one trainer said, reinforcement is in the eye of the person receiving it.
Right.
Not what we decide is reinforcing.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And you say that don't tell people that you're practicing this on them, because if you do, they'll duck. But your husband knows this now. They'll duck if they know it's being done to them, right?
Well, the thing is that there's two things about that. One is, unfortunately, you know, people can take offense with it, especially if they don't really understand what this is about. And then, because it can just, you might not even mean it this way, but if you say, now I'm going to use animal training on you,
right.
People, you know, they get their hackles up.
Yeah, and it's all in good fun.
Right. But the second thing is, moreover, is that this is a way of communicating what you want with your behavior. And so you shouldn't need to say that. You should just do it. It's like the equivalent would be is when you smile, you don't smile and then say to somebody, I'm smiling at you because I really like what you just did. The smile does the job,
mm-hmm.
right? So this is the same idea.
Yeah. Now, you say you used to nag a lot before you learned these techniques. Has that stopped?
Well, I am a human animal. It's improved dramatically. Let's put it that way. I mean, I still have my occasional, you know, nag and frustration acts. But, yeah, I decreased that a lot. And that was probably one of the first things I did, because I realized that nagging actually wouldn't fly in the animal training world for a number of reasons. One, it's punishment.
Mm-hmm.
Two, it's heaping attention on something you don't like. And mm-hmm. generally, trainers ignore what they don't want.
Mm-hmm.
And three, that the fact that I kept nagging was proof that it wasn't working.
Right.
And trainers don't keep using the same technique over and over and over if it's not producing any results.
Right. And they actually say there are no dumb animals. It's just you're not using the right technique on
right.
them. Yeah.
I mean, they use the amazing thing about training these days that people aren't aware of is that these principles work so well and across so many species that they're training species that they never even thought to before, like training dart frogs to jump onto scales so they can get weights, and training sea turtles. And, you know, it just speaks to the power of these simple ideas.
Mm. And for people who might not like the thought of actually animals being trained, I'm talking about the four and, you know, the ones mm-hmm. who fly and the ones who run on four legs now. You say there's absolutely no punishment involved and there's no corrective behavior training either, which actually surprised me that they don't correct bad behavior. They just ignore it.
Well, they will correct it if somebody's about to get hurt or,
right.
you know, something like that, something extreme. But they use it only when they absolutely have to. And the thing is that working with rewards has been, you know, what Skinner showed is working with rewards is more effective and has a more predictable outcome. So it's the better way to work. But generally, it also, when you work with all rewards, you build this profound relationship of trust. And if you use punishment, every time you use punishment, you're drawing down that relationship of trust.
Mm.
And the trainers want a deep sense of trust. And that's why, because they work this way, they're able to train these complicated behaviors and ones where the animal makes themselves vulnerable, especially like for medical procedures. Like, you know, they've trained, you know, animals like rhinos, and I saw a hyena that was trained to do this, to press their, you know, hind or their neck or whatever against their cages so that a vet can do a blood draw.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah.
Isn't that
amazing? You couldn't do this if the animal was kind of anxious about you.
Right, right. We only have a minute or two left, Amy, but I wanted to ask you, what you were working down there with the students with some huge animals. What was your scariest moment with the animals when you were doing your research for this book?
Well, you know, I did some crazy things. I did some things that my friend's 8-year-old daughter told me I should stop doing. But, you know, I went in with a cheetah, and I was around a lot of elephants, and, oh, I got in with a dolphin. But anyhow, the only thing that was really scary was a student was walking a baboon on a leash, and a awning blew out and sort of brushed this baboon, which freaked her out. And so she basically started having a tantrum. And this student was new to this baboon. So there was a few moments, because I was in the general vicinity, where I was afraid the baboon was going to get loose.
Mm.
And but to his credit, he used these techniques and started asking her to do behaviors so that she would focus on him. And as she focused on him, she would have to calm down.
Amazing.
Yeah.
That is so amazing. Well, this is really a great read. It's a fun read, and there are definitely some lessons in there for, you know, working with our pets and with our human animal friends.
That's right.
And so I want you to give out your website so people can check it out, because some of your other books really look fun too.
Oh, thank you. It's amysutherland.com.
Okay, amysutherland.com. And the book is What Shamu Taught Me About Life, Love, and Marriage, Lessons for People from Animals and Their Trainers. And I want to thank each of you for tuning in today. We appreciate you being with us. If you've got feedback on today's show, you can reach me at 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617. Or you can check out more information at conversationslive.net and link straight to Amy's website from there. Please join us next Monday at noon. Until then, live well, live strong. See you next week.
Tune into Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair next Monday at noon and hear how one woman's relentless passion helped to inspire those who were told they were a lost cause. Erin Gruwell joins Vicki to discuss Beyond the Freedom Riders. Also in that hour, find out how to dump that jump with relationship expert and psychologist Dr. Deborah Mandel. That's coming next Monday at noon on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
The answer is easy if you take it logically. I'd like to help you in your struggle to be free. There must be 50 ways to leave your lover.
Views expressed on the preceding program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. This is Alternative Talk, 1150 AM, KKNW Seattle, and KWJZ 98.9 FM, Digital HD3 Seattle.
And a good afternoon to you. Eric Ryder here with you on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM. We're approaching 1 o'clock. It's time once again to take a look at our roadways. Well, State Route 167 northbound at State Route 516, there is an accident blocking the right lane right now, and that is creating a very big backup stretching from